Penguin Random House Audio presents Belonging and Betrayal, How Jews Made the Art World Modern by Charles Delheim. Read for you by Peter Noble. For my magnificent daughters, in order of appearance, Alexandra and Caroline, with all my love. A note on pronunciation from director and reader. In an audiobook which has language and names from so many different cultures and places, words written in the same way may be pronounced very differently in those different cultures and places. We've therefore endeavoured to pronounce according to origin. But in a few cases, where a family operation has moved to a different country, have chosen to change the pronunciation to reflect the pronunciation by which they are known in their new country. For example, the Galerie Wildenstein in Paris and the Wildenstein Gallery in New York. Hath not a Jew eyes? William Shakespeare, The Merchant of Venice. The insecure position of Jews, insecure within themselves, insecure among people, should explain better than anything else why they might think they own only what they hold in their hands or between their teeth, that furthermore, only tangible possessions give them a right to live, and that once they have lost something, they will never again regain it. Rather, it will drift blissfully away from them forever. Franz Kafka, Letter to Milena Jesenska. Europe was not theirs, nor were they Europe's. Philip Roth, The Ghostwriter. Betrayal can only happen if you love. John le Carré, A Perfect Spy. Prologue, The Frame. On May the 3rd, 1945, a man stood outside Buxheim Monastery. The old Carthusian foundation, which was about 90 kilometers to the north of Munich, was a white-walled and red-roofed structure. It dated back to the 15th century and was later rebuilt in the Rococo style. The man was squarely built, though not tall. He may have had more heft and less hair than during his student days, but he was more intense, resourceful, and determined than ever. He had not come to the monastery to study its accretion of architectural forms or its famous decorative carvings, although he would have been at home doing so. Nor had religious impulse driven the man there. The man was on a mission rather than a pilgrimage. Cleveland-born, Harvard-educated, just shy of 40, Lieutenant James Rorimer was a Jewish gentleman, as Army intelligence put it. His first major tour of Europe had been entirely different than his present one. Before going off to college, he had studied art at the École Gorrie in Paris and had travelled in Germany, the land of his paternal ancestors, although his interior designer father had changed the family name from Rohrheimer in 1917, as anti-German prejudice mounted with America's belated entry into the First World War. James Rorimer had had to fight his way into the Second World War. After trying to enlist in the U.S. Army in 1941, months before Pearl Harbor, he was rejected because of high blood pressure. He was plenty busy as director of the Cloisters, the recently opened medieval branch of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which he had helped build. He easily could have sat out the war, cloistered in its safe, tranquil surroundings, overlooking the banks of the Hudson at the upper tip of Manhattan. But he refused to sit still with a war going on. He recruited powerful supporters to press his case to the army. Among them were Paul Sachs, his Harvard mentor, director of the Fogg Museum, and scion of the Goldman Sachs financial dynasty, Robert Lehman, another art-loving heir to a German-Jewish banking family, who later donated a magnificent wing to the Met, and John D. Rockefeller Jr., whose $10 million donation had made the Cloisters possible. Their combined clout pushed the army into giving him another look. In May 1943, he was allowed to enlist as a private. Rorimer was tapped soon after, with some help from Saxe, whose reach extended from Cambridge to New York to Washington, D.C., for a more suitable task. He joined the newly constituted Monuments, Fine Art and Archives, MFA&A section of the U.S. Army, as a G5, Military Government Specialist Officer. His comrades were mainly art historians or museum curators. "Here I have the job of jobs as far as my background and desire are concerned," Rorimer wrote to Saxe from liberated Paris on December the 10th, 1944. His mission was initially to safeguard historic structures threatened by or damaged in battle. In the wake of D-Day, though, the focus shifted to hunting down an unknown quantity of works of art that the Nazis had despoiled as they conquered, occupied, and ransacked one country after another on the continent. This was why Lieutenant Rorimer had come to the Monastery of Buxheim. As the monument's specialist officer for the U.S. 7th Army, he had followed the troops as they battled their way through German territory, vanquished the once formidable but now much weakened Wehrmacht, and took control of one village and town after another as the Third Reich collapsed around them. When Lieutenant Rorimer arrived at 7th Army headquarters, he joined forces with Corporal John D. Skilton, aged 36, who was awaiting his own commission. Skilton was delighted to find that he would be working with an old friend he had known from the museum world, and with whom he had been stationed for a time in England. This Connecticut Yankee, like fictional hero Dink Stover, had done the only decent thing and gone to Yale. Skilton had studied art history in New Haven and then at the University of Paris. Research trips had brought him to Europe 7 times. He had served as a curator at the newly inaugurated National Gallery in Washington, D.C., before enlisting in the army. The two curators worked together for about a month, from early morning until late at night. In an office at military government headquarters, they affixed maps to the walls and employed coloured pins to mark the known and suspected locations of German repositories of stolen art. The mission was nearly scotched before it began. In the final days of the war, when the need to move men and materials trumped other concerns, it was difficult for Rorimer to convince his superiors of the importance of the objects that he and Skilton were trying to find. That he was only a lieutenant, and Skilton a mere corporal, did not help their cause. In a moment of desperation, the two learned curators even considered stealing a car so that they could hunt down Nazi stolen art. Before they tried to pull off this unlikely heist, a Red Cross worker gave them the only aid they needed. He let them borrow his jeep. On May the 3rd, they set off from Augsburg, which once had been a free imperial city, in a non-military vehicle marked with Red Crosses. En route, hopeful American soldiers crowded around the jeep in search of coffee and donuts. First aid they were unfortunately unequipped to supply. Rorimer and Skilton arrived at Buxheim to find American soldiers on guard at the side of the building. Local people, Germans desperately seeking dry goods that had been appropriated from France, had vandalized the room. Nothing in the one crate that they had pried open, though, had had an immediate use to the locals. They ignored or bypassed objects of extraordinary value that the American connoisseurs recognized immediately. As Rorimer and Skilton entered the room, they saw rows of packing cases, 72 in all, stamped fragile. The cases were crammed with beautiful paintings.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?